So, and I think you're going to be more docile.
Well, we'll see whether that's true or not. It's not clear to me that their strategy is a good one. Let me hand back whatever papers I still have left. Some papers mixed in from the other class. I'll just read them. Jeff Rodriguez, Greg Herman, who's in the other class. Lauren Brooks.
That's me.
Ah, Lauren.
Thank you.
You're the one who's covering. Bill Falaro. Wrangley. Griselda. Alex, what's your last name?
Baby.
Yeah. Yeah, two Alexes. Ellen? Nguyen? Yep. Alexander? Yeah. Finally, huh? John? Sarah's sick. Okay. Bill? You go by Bill or something?
I go by Will, but for some reason everyone goes Bill.
Yeah.
I tell them Will, I say Bill.
Jennifer Rodriguez, Knut Lee, Scalen, and Brooke, another class. Okay. Anybody hand me a paper that I haven't gotten back to them?
Bogart, Keelan.
When did you hand me the paper?
I gave it to you for spring break. Well, I left it in your box.
I left it in my box before spring break. I wonder what the hell happened to this. Because I don't remember grading it. Do you have a copy?
I can give you another copy.
Give me those.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah.
I didn't see Justin Babies. Did you bring that up?
Justin, I don't think I got. When did you hand your son?
I didn't see before spring, but actually, fall asleep.
You know what? There must be a folder somewhere in my office with your two papers in it. Let me check. But in the meantime, you know what? Rather than making me wait, why don't you just email me? Just find me. This is a one-time offer. Email me your paper, and I'll grade it and get back to you over email. That way, there'll be no mistakes. Okay. But I'm looking at hard copies, which is possible. Like this. Since they came in early, I just put them in a different place and never looked again. Sorry about that, folks.
Okay. I thought, just real briefly, because I do want to get back to talking about Kant today, I thought the papers in general were pretty good. The usual mistakes that first, you know, philosophy course students make in writing philosophy papers run along two lines. One is that often it's hard for people to catch on to the distinction between asserting beliefs and arguing for them. And with Epicurus, I think it's particularly easy to fail to get that distinction because Epicurus produces compendiums, you know, manuals in which he states his beliefs. But each of the beliefs that Epicurus states, like, for example, that sensation ends at death, has an argument behind it. And it's philosophically relevant only if there is such an argument, because after all, Epicurus was taking a position that was contrary to the dominant position of his day. So simply asserting the opposite of what everyone believes is not enough to carry the position. And so, of course, the argument that is in the background of Epicurus's assertion that sensation ends at death rests on his interpretation of nature and of the soul's place in nature. So, of course, it's the atomic theory of reality that enables him to confidently assert that there will be no consciousness, no conscious sensation after death. And the way the argument goes up, remember, is that nothing exists except atoms in the void. Atoms are eternal, as is empty space, but the composites that atoms enter into are not. They come into and go out of existence. They come into existence when their parts come together, and they go out of existence when their parts split apart. And the soul is a composite, like any other perceptible material substance. So the soul, like every other composite entity, must be temporary in character. It lasts only as long as its component elements hang together. And so once the life process stops, the atoms that comprise the soul decompose. And to decompose means that the complex entity that is the soul ceases to exist, and therefore sensation ceases to exist. So you see what he's done here is he's given us not just the bald assertion that the soul doesn't survive the body. He's given us an argument to back up his assertion. And so to challenge that, you would have to say, you know, wait a minute, the reasoning that you're using is flawed, or your philosophy of nature is inadequate. But it's hard to do that because every step of the way, Epicurus justifies the statements that he makes about nature. You know, there have to be atoms because there are composites, right? Composites break down into their parts. We have to ultimately end up with a fundamental part, and that fundamental part is the atom. Clearly, you know, how could we not end up with a fundamental part? If nothing exists but atoms in the void, then there is no God that exists outside of the system. If nothing, Epicurus doesn't say nothing exists but atoms in the void and God, right? That there's a third entity here. How would you even make sense of such a third entity? Is it composite? Is it incomposite? You know, it's neither, right? So Epicurus essentially dismisses the idea of a God outside of the universe as a fiction. But if there's no God outside of the universe, there's no God that can create the universe. The universe is self-sustaining. It's eternally existent. And the soul is a part of it, right? So what you get here is an argument based on his philosophy of nature, both against the notion that, you know, the gods are in charge of everything and are in a position to reward and punish people, and also an argument against fearing death, because death is the end of sensation, the end of the continued existence of the conscious self. Yes?
So you're saying that unless God can break down into its purest form, an atom, it can't exist in the universe because it doesn't react, doesn't respond to the laws of the universe?
Yeah, what Epicurus is depending upon here is an understanding of what it means for something to exist. And he's beginning with the only evidence that we've got to go on, namely the evidence that our senses bring us. Remember, he says that sensation is the doorway to knowledge. And what do we experience through sensation? We experience a universe of things coming into and going out of existence. But now let's analyze what that means. And when he analyzes what it means, he ends up with this notion that things come into existence when they come together from fundamental parts, and they go out of existence when they break apart into their ultimate constituents. If the gods have a place, their place will be within that framework. And Epicurus says, well, they do have a place. They're composites. You know, they're particularly rarefied forms of soul substance that exist intermundia, you know, between the universes. And by saying that they exist between the universes, what he means to get at is that they're not concerned with the affairs of any particular world. And now what he does is he takes these gods, which are part of the machinery of nature rather than the origins of that machinery, and he says, well, what's their function? Their function really is to act, as many people caught on, as role models. You know, they are the beings who are involved in happy, you know, pleasurable self-absorption. They're blissful. And imagine that you were blissful. Right. Imagine that all of your needs were satisfied and your body and mind were functioning at their optimal condition. Are you really going to be concerned about whether he sacrifices a bull to you? What the hell do you care? Right? There's nothing that you lack. Right? Yeah.
Well, the one thing that's unusual is that I was reading Roman ideology that the gods seem to be flawed in that they crave amusement from mortals, and the offerings, it's not so much that they need their bodily needs met or their mind, their knowledge fulfilled. It's that they're amused by lesser beings.
They're bored.
Yeah.
They're bored and they want entertainment.
Right.
So they have, the Trojans capture Helen and a war start. And thousands of people die as a result to keep them entertained.
All right.
And you know, Plato addresses this issue about the traditional understanding of the gods too. And he says, look, this is a misunderstanding of what the gods are. Because obviously the gods can't possess the other characteristics that we attribute to them. Wisdom, goodness, and so forth, if they're willing to torment the human species for their own entertainment. And basically, so he challenges the traditional conception of the gods, but he challenges it in favor of a more transcendent notion of what he calls the absolute good. Epicurus also challenges the traditional understanding of the gods. But he but he challenges it in the name of the materialist analysis of the universe and of the God's place within the universe. In any event, the idea of creation is kind of muted in Greek and Roman mythology anyway. And creation is really something that comes in with Christianity. At least creation as we think of it, or with Judaism actually. Creatio ex nihilo, creation out of nothing. Now, when the gods and other traditions make a world, they shape a pre-existing substance. You know, it's already there, right? And they just, you know, it's chaos, it's some indistinct mixture, and they sort of sculpt it. But in Judaism and Christianity and Islam, you know, God brings the whole thing into existence out of nothing, because obviously, if something existed in addition to God, then God would not be infinite, as the religions of the book claim he is. Right.
Well, not to get off topic from Kant, but I'm just wondering, what is it with the fascination with creation out of nothing argument and the crisis of knowing whether or not something has existed always or nothing has existed and something came out of it? Because you see in Greek religion and philosophy that they're concerned more about how to live a good life instead of how things began. So I'm wondering, why is it that one has a crisis and one?
Well, you have to understand think about the development of religious thought from the Greeks and the Romans to the, you know, through the Jewish tradition, through Christianity and Islam. What you have here is a development in the direction of monotheism. You know, the Greeks are polytheists, as many of the pre-Hebrew peoples of the Middle East were polytheists, and as many of the, of course, the Roman and Greek influenced culture of Palestine pre-Christ was polytheist and so forth. So in the religions of the book, you know, there are three, right? There's the Old Testament, the New Testament, and the Quran. There's a very strong movement in the direction of monotheism. There is only one God. You know, I'm a jealous Lord. You know, you shall have no gods before me, right? And monotheism is first really established in the Old Testament and then the New, and then carried on in the New and then in the Quran. But think of what it means to be a monotheist. There's only one God. Well, what is the function of that God? The function, since all of these traditions carry ultimately themselves back to Genesis, is to initially create everything that exists. But if there's only one God, and if God creates everything that exists, then he must create ex nihilo, because there's nothing outside of it. Let's say that there were a second entity besides God. Well, then you would have God plus something that God did not create. But if God did not create that thing, then it seems that you now have, you're on a slippery slope in the direction of polytheism again. Not one principle, but two. Yeah?
Well, it's not necessarily that you could also say, you know how the infinity symbol encompasses, you know, an infinite realm of numbers with a single symbol? Well, the Revelation, the first chapter, when they're like, I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, the first and the last. Well, it's almost like you could express the infinity of creation as a single one.
But how do you mean? I'm not sure what the point is you're making.
What the point is I'm making? Well, it's a sort of a transcendent unity of what is. It doesn't necessarily have to have anything to do with origin.
Right. I see what you're saying. Well, sure. I think that's true. And there are tendencies within Western religious thought to move in that direction. In other words, to stress the omega rather than the alpha. Now, alpha is the first letter in the Greek alphabet. Omega is the last letter. So I am the alpha and the omega means I am the one who comes first and I am the one who comes last. Well, if you stress the first part of it, then what you stress is God as creator. If you stress the omega part of it, the last part of it, then you have God as the being who sums up and gives an elevated expression to everything that has gone before him. So is that's what you're getting at?
Yeah, it's like the unity of dimensional reality and space and time and all the, you know, that's always how I thought of it.
But you've had so many drug experiences.
Well, yeah.
But then, probably so did the prophets and founders of those religions.
This is my theory. Is
well, I just have a point. You know, like, this is, don't worry about gods, because I'm the god, meaning there's only one god. But when we say don't worry about the gods, because we, as human beings, we can provide to ourselves. You know?
Now, what Epicurus challenges, Epicurus comes before Christianity, obviously, right? Mm-hmm. Epicurus was born 300 years prior to the birth of Christ. So he's not addressing the Christian tradition. Mm-hmm. Palestine is around, but when Epicurus is writing, Alexander is just beginning to conquer the Middle East. So the Middle Eastern religions really don't play a role here. Now, the monotheistic religions don't play a role. Judaism, in other words. What he's doing is he's looking at the traditional Greek beliefs. And the traditional Greek beliefs is that there are many gods. Those gods have an influence and an interest in human affairs. And we sacrifice to them, for example, in order to prevent bad things from happening to us. We also worry about our judgment by the gods after we die, and so on. So what Epicurus says is, if you understand what the gods are, namely, eternally blissful beings, then you will see that they're not concerned with people, that they're not interested in getting sacrifices from people, and they're not interested in punishing people. And therefore, fear of the gods drops away. Now, he doesn't... It would be anachronistic to say that he's confronting Christianity here because the Christians don't exist yet. Later on, Christianity will come into existence. And that's the way that Hebraic culture will impress itself on the Greco-Roman world, right? It's through Christianity. Now what you get is later debates between Christianity and later Epicureans. And of course, the Christians see very clearly that the Epicureans are going to be their primary enemy. Because the Epicureans have a completely naturalistic understanding of the world and of the soul's place within the world. It's not just the fact that they argue that the gods are concerned with against the fact that the gods are concerned with human beings. Even more importantly, they argue that we have nothing to fear from death. Well, if you don't have anything to fear from death, there's no judgment. If there's no judgment, there's no penance. If there's no penance, there's no church. Thing? Yeah.
Well, even if they seem to argue the fundamental values of the church, I don't see Epicureans as big of a threat nearly as the church is, mainly because Epicureans' main idea is to go about life not harming anybody because it's the right thing to do, not because someone tells you to do it.
Yes.
So it seems like it's not nearly as at odds as they would think they're at, because...
But look at how much at odds that really is. Let's say it turns out, and this is Epicure... You're right, this is another very revolutionary implication of Epicureanism. People don't need priests to be moral. Mm-hmm. You know, there are completely sufficient internal reasons to be moral. Right. Now, the reason why I should not steal from you or kill you is that if I do, I break the bond that connects people in a community that's capable of protecting each of us. So it's within my self-interest to be moral. You know, if we unleash the forces of theft and murder, we break up the community, and then we're each on his or her own, facing the hostile world around us. So Epicurus says, of course nobody is going to want to do that. Why shouldn't you lead a life of complete sexual promiscuity? It's not because God doesn't like sex. It's because if you do, you won't have lasting relationships. Or you'll, get a venereal disease and whatnot, right? Why shouldn't you stuff yourself the way the Romans do at the banquets? It's not because God doesn't like overindulgence. It's because your body doesn't like it. So the reasons for moral behavior don't require any reference to God, and therefore they don't require the intercession of priests and ministers. So once again, these guys find themselves without a living. Yeah.
Although, even if they don't necessarily require them, it's always nice to have it reinforced for people who have a crisis in their life where they don't realize their true moral reasoning of why they're supposed to be a certain way. So they're good as guidance, almost like guidance counselor kind of idea, but they're not ultimately necessary, but they're good just for safety net for some people.
Yeah, but you see, that's the role of the leaders of the Epicurean community. And that's the reason why Epicureanism does strangely have something like the structure of a church.
Right.
You know, it has sayings, it has symbols. You know, the Epicureans had rings, signet rings, like Masonic rings, with Epicurus's portrait on the gems, carved into the gems. Or they had placards up in their home of Epicurus's portrait with the sayings of Epicurus, sort of like the pictures of Jesus you find in some houses now, right? So they created a kind of secular, non-religious church, if you can imagine such a thing. You know?
It's not too far-fetched, I think, though, because people crave advice and what to do with their life and their direction.
Yeah, and also just a community of people that at least appear to be concerned about them. When it's funny, I had a little demonstration of this when I went home to Jersey to visit my 83-year-old mother. She lives in a retirement community in sort of a rural part of New Jersey. And there's a highway that goes past her community. And on the other side of the highway is a church. And it's this is Jersey, so, mostly it's synagogues and Catholic churches. But this church is a Baptist church or some evangelical derivative of baptism, right? So there was a storm, prior to the break. So I was raking my mother's lawn and getting rid of the branches and leaves for her, and I see this guy coming from the distance, and I don't know the neighborhood that well, so I figured he was just a retiree and just wanted to talk to me about something. He came up to me and he started to talk, and it turned out he was the minister of the Baptist church. And he asked me whether he could cross through and come to the church, come behind the church. And I said, well, yes, I don't care if he crossed through or not. And so what was he doing? Well, this guy has two jobs, evidently. One job is he's minister of this church. The other job is he must have some kind of a sales job that takes him out to the West Coast. So he's gotten into the habit, get this, I mean, this is the way religions have changed. He's gotten into the habit, when he's on the West Coast, of delivering his sermon to the congregation over Skype. So they set up a computer, on the altar, and you see the guy's face pops up, and he delivers the sermon, and he'll even talk with parishioners over Skype. So they think he's in California, but his trip was called off, and they're expecting to see his picture on Skype, but he's actually going to walk into the church physically and surprise them. And I said to him, well, just claim it's a miracle. I mean, you can get at least apostolic status out of this. I said, you don't have to claim it's the second coming. You don't have to go that far. But at least, a miracle. And he laughed. But, you realize what keeps the people in the church together. It's not just their beliefs. It's the fact that there's a kind of community, a jovial community, which somebody's playing tricks on all of them, and they're all going to laugh together and talk about it and so forth. And given the anonymity of American culture, that's a real kind of lifesaver for a lot of people. Yeah, yeah. And so that's what the Epicurean organization was doing in the world of the Roman Empire, was creating those kinds of enclaves of community, but on a non-religious basis. Yeah. Okay, folks, before the class totally gets away from us, let me try to make the transition from Kant's basic moral principle to his treatment of perpetual peace. Remember we said, I'm not going to write it down again, I'll just say them. Remember we said that the basic principle of morality is what Kant calls the categorical imperative. It's a filtering principle in the sense that it filters out those candidates for morality that aren't genuinely moral. So it filters out things like thou shalt enslave the Africans, or thou shalt annihilate the Jews, or whatnot. And it filters them out on the basis of their failure to meet the standard of universalizability. Remember, for Kant, all genuine moral principles have to be universalizable. And so he demonstrates this through our ordinary attempts to get ourselves off the hook. It's okay for me to steal something when I really want it. What Kant points out is I do not mean to say that it's okay for everybody to steal something when they really want it, because if that's what I meant to say, then my property would be insecure. What I really mean is that I want the principle to hold for everybody but me. And we see here what the essence of morality is. The essence of morality is universalizability. It's the fact that moral principles, in order to be genuinely moral, must hold for all concerned. And what that means is that I have to stop making a special case of myself. I have to treat myself the way I treat everybody else within the moral context. Now, Kant says that there is a second formulation of the categorical imperative that brings out the identical universalizable character of moral principle, but it does it in a more concrete way. I forget whether I put it down on the board. I'll put it on. Do you have it?
Yeah, it's act always in such a way that you treat humanity, whether in your own person or that of another, always as an end and never as a means.
Right. Always as an end and never as a means merely. You see, to say that moral principles have to be universalizable, what that really means is that everybody affected by them must be treated with respect. They must be treated as ends and not as means merely. To treat something as a means merely is to treat it as an object of your own desires, a tool for achieving what you want to achieve. Things may be legitimately used that way. Things are instruments, tools that we use to go about achieving our ends. But people are ends in themselves. And even when we have to use them as means, as we often do in social life, we buy something, or you know, when we go to a doctor or whatnot, we're using another person as a means, we are not using them as means merely. We are also recognizing that they are beings deserving of respect. What makes them, Kant will say later, beings deserving of respect is that they are rational entities just as we are. See, like the Stoics, Kant regards the possession of reason as the criterion of membership in the moral community. Things do not possess reason. In other words, things do not conduct their own lives on the basis of reflection. And he includes animals here. You know, animals are alive, certainly, and they have lives, but they don't act on the basis of rational principle as human beings do. And so the primary moral community, actually the only moral community, is the community of rational beings. It turns out, I think I've said this before, if it turns out that somebody drops down from Venus and they possess rationality,
they can talk.
They can talk. You know, we can sort of figure out that they have a language. We can talk about motives for action. Why did you decide to come here? You know, they can give a response and so forth. Then they are now a part of the universal moral community. It's not our species membership that makes us part of the moral community. It's our possession of reason.
Well, even in, for example, animals that don't possess reason, does he say that they're at least worthy of, maybe not so much respect nearly as a person who possesses reason, but do they possess any sort of dignity? For example, don't just cut off their leg and laugh at them?
Well, Kant is rather, he has a position that not all animal lovers are going to accept here. He's not as radical as Spinoza. Spinoza says you can do anything you want with animals. You know, they're just instruments for our use. What Kant says is that if you have someone who is cruel to animals, you know, that there's a good reason for prohibiting cruelty to animals. And the good reason is a person who derives pleasure in the pain of animals is likely to derive pleasure in the pain of people. right? In other words, that a person who gets pleasure from pain is someone, that's at the very least, that's a behavior you want to discourage. And so we could very easily have rules and laws that protect animals from unnecessary suffering. But the point of those rules and laws is to protect people rather than animals.
That's fair.
Yeah.
You said Kant said that?
Yeah.
Did Freud also say that like kids who tortured like ants, like magpie gosses, are showing early signs of being a serial killer? Is that Freud?
No.
Well, I heard something like that, that kids who pay attention to what your kids like to do with like...
If they're ripping wings off flies and stuff like that, watch out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would. If I were you, I'd keep an eye on Johnny or Jill. Okay. The transition to perpetual peace. We should treat everybody as a person, everybody as a being deserving of respect. War is the biggest violator of that. In war, we treat people as things rather than as persons. And this is clearly the case when it comes to the enemy, right? The enemy soldier is somebody who stands in the way of us achieving our goal. Perhaps it's the conquest of some territory or the defense of some territory. The enemy soldier stands in the way of us achieving our goal, and we regard it as legitimate, if he's armed, to annihilate him. In other words, we treat him as a thing. Now, Kant goes further than this. He says that not only do we treat enemy soldiers as things, as means merely, rather than ends in themselves, we treat the soldiers of our own army that way. And his emphasis is on that. He says, why? Because what an army does is it takes a person and it turns him or her into a killing machine. In other words, into a means for the accomplishment of an external end. And therefore, war is a, especially, you know, war of, that involves a great number of deaths, is a massive violator of the categorical imperative. What that means is, by the basic principle of morality, we all have an obligation to work toward the end of war, provided one thing, provided that it's possible. If it's impossible to end war, then obviously there can be no obligation to do so, any more than you have an obligation to levitate 6 feet above your desk. But if it is possible to put an end to war, then our primary moral obligation as human beings is to work toward that end. And that's the moral framework within which he writes Perpetual Peace, which we will begin to discuss in detail finally next time. Okay? I'm sorry, I didn't give you a chance to answer the question.
I was just going to add an example, I guess, of desensitizing an enemy, but also looking at an example where the exact same as you is all quiet on the Western Front, where we all have the German soldiers.
The same misery in both trenches.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And most soldiers actually come to an understanding of that. It's a kind of... you know, common bond of feeling that often connects soldiers on opposite sides of the war. Yeah. Oh, thank you.
I'm going to need that since my friend couldn't find
one. I'm sorry. Once you give me something, forget it. You'll never see it again. No, I'll
give it to you. Well, if you want to bring it, I just didn't have any extra discs and I couldn't find my copy.
I think, how much is in there? If this is a DVD?
Yeah.
Is it copyable?
Yes. Yeah. The first, like 3 or 4 minutes is only audio.
Right.
And then the first... 11 or 12 is when it really starts.
Oops. I don't have... Well, you know what I'll do here? This is what I'll do.
You can take it.
I'll take it and copy it in my office, and I'll leave it in my office so I don't forget to do that.
Okay.
So if I forget to bring it next time, just tell me.
Well, I don't need it right away.
So. Yeah, but believe me, I've been through this before. Students come after me 5 years later and say, remember that book I loaned you? Yeah, by that time, they're like, district attorneys.
Is there ever a justification for war for a short time in Kant's view? For example, if one side is trying to disrupt the human rights of another side, is it justifiable even though it's discouraged.
Well, that's a major issue that we're going to take a look at when we read the provisions of perpetual peace. But I should say, in general, you know, Kant sees that within the existing order of things, war is unavoidable, and that there are reasons to go to war within this order. So the issue is not abstract pacifism. The issue is getting beyond this order into a different one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But to have soldiers is to protect your order.
Kant says that. And there is a good reason for doing that. Because it says a nation is not just a piece of property. It's not just a piece of ground. It's a community. In other words, it has the status of a collective person. So protecting the rights of the collective person is a legitimate thing to be doing. But the problem is that while everybody is doing this,
you're denying someone else their rights.
Well, we're all laying the ground for our nesting structure.
Yeah.
So how do you get beyond that?
It'd be over-exaggerating with the...
But if people's opinions change, just because over here you think this is order, and over here they don't think it's order, so...
That's an issue, too.
Whose order is correct?
No maintained order is it. What's, you know, what... about unconsumed war, you know, so that's the problem.
Well, you know, but it is interesting. Kant will say that's true, but part of his solution is that states become republics, because you see one of the defining characteristics of a republic is that a republic respects the rights of its citizens.
Right.
But once you get respect for rights institutionalized on the level of a government, then the next step is, of course, recognizing that there's such a thing as universal human rights. And there has been an evolution in that direction. So there's the UN statement.
The EU.
So yeah. UN is republic.
Well, the UN is an attempt, actually. It was the second attempt to bring Kant's vision to life.
Oh.
The first one was the League of Nations.
Oh.
And I mean, this is, as a matter of fact, Kant refers to a League of Nations in the... Those are the words that he uses in the document. And international legal specialists have read Kant, in particular a fellow by the name of Hans Kelsen. And Kelsen was the primary mind behind the construction of the League of Nations and the United Nations. So there's a direct line between perpetual peace and
what about the League of Nations somewhat under? I know Alexander the Great had somewhat of a similar idea when they had a need.
But a League of Nations with the notion that each nation maintains political sovereignty and that the purpose of the League is to avoid war between nations.
Well, actually, that might have been more of I was thinking more of the Athenian War when they had on both sides when they had
different alliances. There've been plenty of alliances.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Never mind. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. There've been plenty of alliances. A League of Nations is something different.
Okay. Yeah. The way you define other people's sides.
Yeah.
I like that statement. You know what you just said. Each.
Have their own political.
Yeah, public sovereignty. Each, each country maintaining
to avoid war. So the notion, I mean, ultimately we're going to see this as the way it evolves, but ultimately the idea is that the purpose of, he calls it an international federation of states, the purpose of a federation is not to make law for any particular nation.
But then you say there is no federation?
No. Kant wants a federation.
Oh, but... Right now, we don't, right? That's what you said. I think you said.
The UN is not quite that. And we'll take a look at it. I mean, the UN deviates in major ways from Kant's document. But whether Kant is right or wrong is another issue, right? In other words, could there be such an association as the one that Kant describes? We get into the tricky problem of translating philosophical ideals into reality here, right? Yeah. Take care now. Take care. How you doing?
I jelled up.
You having trouble with the paper?
Yeah.